As I prepared this lecture on the book of Job, I reminded myself that I had treated this subject three times before. I went back and I reread those texts, and I found to my surprise that in each case I had described a different Job. In retrospect, no greater tribute can be paid to a work of literature. For what is the mark of excellence in writing but its ability to refract to us a new color, a new aspect of the human experience at each reading? I first treated of Job in those difficult years between the end of the Second World War and the establishment of the State of Israel. The years in which we became aware of the degrading agony of the Nazi Holocaust, in which we did not know yet where the displaced in the camps would be placed, and in which we were still uncertain that a Zion would be reborn. And I read Job in those days as an affirmation of the indomitable will of man. Job became a personification of the staunchness of man, our ability to accept the most cruel of fates, to survive and maintain our sanity and build again. Job was whipped, manhandled, and scoured, scourged, and he did not whine. Job was beaten and bludgeoned, and he did not break. You remember the prologue of Job. God is proud of his creation, man, but Satan is cynical. Oh yes, men appear to be virtuous and good, but they are self-serving. If they did not expect a reward, if they did not expect the accolade of their neighbors, position in their communities, God, you would see quite another kind of human being. Job is sacrificed as a test, for he is the paragon of mortals, the best of us. He is generous, great-hearted, of position in his community, yet humble and patient, loyal to his family, deeply loving, the summation of all that is fine and noble in human character. And Satan is quite confident that he can break Job's equanimity, break him down, and reveal a quite more animal, quite less noble man. God agrees to the test. And in startlingly rapid succession, Job is whipped. His wealth is erased. His home, his barns are razed. His servants are led captive. His children are murdered. Job is stripped bare. And then the Bible tells us Job rose up, and he rent his mantle, and he shaved his head, all signs of traditional mourning. And he fell upon the ground, and he worshipped. And he said, "Naked I came out of my mother's womb, and naked I shall return there. The Lord has given, the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord." And for all this, Job sinned not. Neither did he speak aught that was unseemly of God. God believes his point to have been made. Satan asks for a second chance. He has not yet touched Job's own person. And God said, "Behold, he is in thy hand. Only spare his life." And in quick succession, Job is made to suffer boils and shingles and that ugliest of all diseases, elephantiasis. And his wife turns to him and she says, "Dost thou still hold fast to thine integrity? Blaspheme God and die." And Job says to her, "Behold, thou speakest as one of the irreverent women speakest. What shall we receive? Good at the hand of the Lord and not evil also?" For all this, Job sinned not with his lips. I was reading in those days those scraps of diary and memoir which somehow had survived the Nazi Holocaust, the Satan of our contemporary days. Allowed it to maintain its decency, its wholeness, its sanity, even its faith. When the knock of the SS on the door was only a matter of days, and it was only a number of nights until there would be the final eternal midnight. Somehow Job became the prototype of human staunchness. He and his modern exemplars spoke to me of a revealing and healing truth that somehow, despite the most heinous and bitter of cruelties which man can inflict upon his fellow, despite the degradation of the satanic demons of our world, man can and will survive. As the psalmist said, we are most wondrously made. We have within us a capacity to surmount the insurmountable, to stand firm beyond the limits of human capacity. Somehow beyond Auschwitz there would be a Zion. Somehow beyond the eternal cycle of war and narrow peace and war again, more brutal war, there would be a larger peace, hope for man. Job had faced his future without illusion. The grave, Job says, the grave is open for me. Nor had Job posited for himself some blissful paradise beyond the purgatory of this life. Man, he said, lieth down and he dieth, and unto the heavens shall depart, he shall not awaken. Job did not hold fast to any illusion. He looked into the jaws of hell straight on, yet he retained his faith, his courage. I find this a healing truth, although I confess that it puts into a shoddy and shabby relief the measure of our own complaints. How often we, the affluent, we, the peaceful, we who have hardly known suffering, bathe ourselves in safe and self-pity. A promotion has been denied us. A club has barred its doors to us. A friend has spoken ill of us. We literally make ourselves miserable over such a trifle. Job, who knew suffering, the bitter edge of the sword, the sword that touches the quick flesh, Job maintained his integrity. Job never whimpered. He complained, but he maintained his dignity. Job, for all his pain, my friends, never took a tranquilizer. I came again to Job during the first years of my ministry, when I was spending a great deal of time with the bereaved and the desperately ill for the first time. And I came to see then another Job, a Job who was, in a sense, the prototype of the suffering soul. I was especially struck during those years with the series of dialogues which take place between Job and his three friends who come to console him: Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar. These dialogues occupy the larger part of the 40 chapters of Job. The friends try and speak words of comfort to him, and Job, as you know, will not accept their philosophy or their justification. I came to understand these speeches because as I made my condolence calls and my hospital visits, I saw Eliphaz's and Bildad's, and Zophar's. You have seen them too. Zophar, Eliphaz is usually an elderly, worldly wise gentleman or gentle lady. He has seen the widow in her tears, and he has seen the widow at her remarriage. He knows that the life goes on, and that this living room bathed in grief will someday be bathed in flowers at another wedding. And he comes in, and he pats the bereaved upon the hand, and he counsels them to take faith, to hold fast, that there will be, in not too many moons, a new life, new hope, laughter in your eyes, joy in your heart, in your face, love in your heart. Bildad is of another sort. Bildad is of that type of human being who can put any tragedy into good relief. He does not look the tragedy square on. Rather, he asks, what could have been more tragic? And then seeks to explain to us our suffering. We have lost a loved one. We've lost him early on in life. And what does he say to us? It could have been worse. Your beloved was a proud person, proud of his dignity. He would not have wanted to be an invalid, paralyzed. Or if we are ill and suffering some permanent disability, he tells us all that he can of those who have suffered a worse disability, who have managed somehow to build a life. Bildad is that cheery sort who braces us, tells us to go on. And Zophar is a younger person yet, one who has really not experienced life, but who understands all the jargon of psychiatric therapy. Zophar explains to us what is happening to us. Good, express yourself, cry, give vent to your anger, it's good for you, you feel the better. Try and understand yourself, you'll come to understand what's happened to you. Keep going, keep talking, all will work out. These friends of Job have their parallels, have they not? And they were friends of Job, and they meant well. And they are our friends, and their words are kindly meant. But their words are irrelevant. Their words are burdensome to us. They only sharpen the hurt. Why, Job says, why do you vex my soul? Why do you crush me with words? Job will have none of these justifications, none of these rationalizations, none of these explanations of his cruel fate. They are irrelevant, despite their wisdom. They are irrelevant to what has happened to him here and now, at this moment. And yet, they are not irrelevant. And they are not unkind, though they sharpen the bitterness of the hour. For they are in the book of Job, and they provide for Job a foil, a sounding board for his own fumblings of meaning. Read the book of Job, and read especially these dialogues between Job and his friends, and you'll be struck by one fact. Job never answers directly the arguments of his friends. His mind is working at its own pace. His friends come and speak. And their listening, their presence, gives Job the opportunity to speak himself, to work out his own fate, some explanation of his own destiny. And so the lesson of the book of Job is not to make a condolence call. And the lesson of the book of Job is not to offer what consolation you can, but to offer it without insisting upon it, to offer it without assuming that you are giving to that person a logic of belief and of bereavement, but offering it to him so that he can seize on it, take from it what he needs, and sound off back to you as he tries to work out the cruelties and the incongruity of life, his life at this moment, his grief, his hurt, the pain which no one else can know, no one else can suffer. I reread Job some years later and found another Job, a Job who points the way to an understanding of the meaning of faith. These were years in which religion was being huckstered about the United States with great success. Money back, 5-year warranty religion. Faith was a guarantee. Faith gave you confidence. Confidence unleashed the powers within. Confidence improved your chance of success in life. Faith was a guarantee of a better life. You remember Dr. Norman Vincent Peale and the power of positive thinking? If you believe, he said, if you believe deeply enough and pray fervently enough, your power comes to the fore. You develop the capacity to be a super salesman. You can join the million-dollar round table. And there were many, a luncheon and a breakfast with Dr. Peale and the great insurance corporations of America. If you believe fervently enough, if you pray with enough devotion, you will overcome your shyness and your diffidence. You will open yourself up to love and to feeling. You will gain social acceptance and even the marriage, which is your heart's desire. Now, faith can work miracles, except when faith doesn't work miracles. I remember the young lady who sat in my office. Her eyes were dry of tears. She was beyond them. She sat there kneading her handkerchief. Rabbi, she said, I believed. I believe. Really, I do. I went to my synagogue. I prayed. I was desperately in love. I wanted to be part of this man's life. I felt if only I could have confidence. And you know, Rabbi, I did gain confidence. And he did learn to respect me. But now he has left me, and I am with child. Faith can work miracles except when faith works tragedy. And I would give in those years to people who had misled by the hucksterism of faith. I used to give them the book of Job. For what was its central problem? Job, a man of faith, a man of virtue, a man who had every reason to be confident of his future. A man whose world had suddenly nevertheless opened up underneath him. A man who had to ask himself the simple question, can I still have faith in a world where God manhandles me? Can I still have faith in God if my God is unpredictable, if he does not return kindness for devotion, reward for service? When the three friends come to pay their condolence calls to Job, they seek to explain God's ways to him. They too are afraid that his faith will be crushed. One of them says to him, Job, understand why God has put suffering into the world. What does suffering do? Suffering makes us more sensitive to the feelings of others. We understand their needs, their desperation, their loneliness. We are the better, the more great-hearted, the more generous for it. Suffering is not evil. Suffering is purpose. And another friend says to him, Job, have patience. The world has a way of balancing out. Hitler may bestride the world for a decade, but he will die and be cremated in his own air raid shelter. Have patience, and you will see your reward. And his third friend says to him, Job, have a little more self-understanding. Each of us, being mortal, has an ego. And our ego blinds us to our own nature. We think we are good and responsible, and we deny to us all evidence of our irresponsibility, of our various selfishnesses. Job rejects these explanations. Nothing that he has done merits the burden that has been placed upon him. Then a strange and marvelous turn takes place in the story of Job. These conversations between Job and his friend have been going on and on and on and on, and they are suddenly and abruptly and without explanation cut off. And God enters the picture. God speaks to Job out of a whirlwind. And God makes no attempt to explain to Job his fate. He makes no excuses for what has happened. He does not say, Satan and I were arguing and yours was a test case. I really didn't mean it. Rather, he speaks to Job of the divine grandeur and of man's finite measure. Where wast thou when I laid the foundations of the earth? Canst thou loose the spring winds and separate them to the corners of the earth? Canst thou loose the bands of the Pleiades and bind the cords of Orion? Didst thou give to the horse its strength, and is it by thy wisdom that the hawk soars in the heaven? Job, after this magnificent theophany, this magnificent description of nature and of the power behind nature, makes a most revealing statement. He speaks to God. I had seen thee, I had heard of thee with the hearing of mine ears, but now I see thee with mine own eyes. I've discovered a strange thing about tragedy. Tragedy very rarely snuffs out faith. One would expect otherwise. One would expect one who has been beaten to his knees to cry out and to deny. And sometimes one hears this verbally. How can one believe in God, in a God who will take one so young? But there is a stronger truth which swells over us at the moment of death and of hurt. On our knees, we look up, and we see beyond the normal world of our routines and of our ambitions, the larger world, the world of thrust, of power, of limitless time and of energy. We see the power which we could not stay, the death we could not avoid, the cycles of life and death, of nature, the seasons, of the heavens, to which we can only bow in submission. My ears have heard the logic of faith, but now I see the power of God with mine own eyes. The moment of tragedy, we come closest to an awareness of the fullness of God's power, of his might, become closest to faith. Faith is not an axiom of God's goodness, but of God's greatness. It comes to us not because we can explain that which happens to us in this life, but because there is life itself and death, because there are joy and tears, because our eyes begin to see an expanding infinity of which we are only the most infinitesimal of parts. There's a professor of philosophy at Princeton University, Dr. Walter Kaufmann, who has written a most interesting volume entitled The Faith of a Heretic. Dr. Kaufmann makes much of the book of Job. He sees how Job rejects the arguments, the rationalizations of his friends. He sees how Job confronts the tragic power, as he calls it, of the world. And he says, this is man. This is the ultimate truth of philosophy. There is a power beyond us, and this power makes no sense except that it is there, and man must, as best he can, and with what composure and equanimity he can muster, simply accept the fact of that power. His is a modern stoicism. But the ultimate logic of this position, it's a logic which Nietzsche drew 100 years ago. There is beyond an absurd power, a power which has no purpose and no meaning as far as it affects our lives. Then let us, each of us, strive to be the most powerful. No more compunctions about morality, no more sensitivity to another's need. Let us simply build our castle as strong as we can and hide behind it for as much protection as we can muster. If this position has meaning, all the sanctities of Jewish life have no meaning. The mitzvah, the commandment, the Torah, the learning, prophecy, the moral passion. What purpose has this in a powerful but purposeless world? Dr. Kaufmann and Nietzsche before him, the Stoics before them, misunderstood the totality of Job's meaning. For the God who reveals himself in Job reveals not only naked power, but purposeful power. He speaks always of the wisdom which has been impregnated into the universe, the order that is there, the thoughtfulness that has gone into it. The world is not an aimless structure. It has form. It has dimension. And if we cannot comprehend the totality of its purpose, we can still see that it is purposeful and meaningful. And here, I think, is the ultimate philosophic implication of the book of Job. His three friends have made explanation. They have sought to explain why it is that the righteous sometimes suffer. And each of these explanations has a certain merit to it. We do become more sympathetic when we have suffered. We have seen giddy young people who, when first faced by tragedy, mature and come adult. There is a strange way in this world in which, given enough time, the wicked are brought low. And it is true that our egos blind us to some of our favorite faults. But each of these explanations only explains one little dimension of the total problem. What Job does is to reject them as total explanations. And he looks beyond for that explanation. And again, he finds no totality, no complete answer. Life is ultimately beyond logic. But he sees there a purpose which gives him hope. A purpose which makes him feel that all is not meaningless, and hopeless, and lost. Life, God, man, can simply not be circumscribed neatly within the categories of human thought. But that does not mean that they are without thought. And I find in this last statement the meaning of Job 1964. For I find myself increasingly surrounded by men and women who insist on thinking in neat and complete philosophies. They call them isms. There is an orthodoxy and a heresy, a truth and deviation. I care not now what that ism is. Socialism, conservatism, liberalism, communism, constitutionalism. You've heard these words bandied about. And you've seen people who are caught up in these theories. Ultimately, the book of Job gives the lie to all of them. For life is beyond theory. We read this morning that magnificent chapter in Job, which asks, where is wisdom and what is the place of understanding? It is not theology. It is not even answered that it is the Bible. Where is the place of wisdom? Behold, the reverence of the Lord, that is wisdom. And what is the place of understanding? Behold, to depart from evil, that is understanding. Life is beyond logic. It is not the splitting of theories, but the building of cities which teaches truth to men. It is not the precision of one's argument, but the justice of one's law which establishes truth in life. And if we can only remember that this openness of discussion, this freedom for experimentation, this willingness to listen to other points of view, this acceptance that truth cannot be confined within the four L's of any value, this I find to be the Job who has meaning for me at this moment in time. And there I think we have its enigma. But when I pick up Job next year, on the next occasion when I will speak of him to you, what Job will we find then? Amen.